The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, so much for the philosophical background. Anyway, moving on. The age of rationalism in biblical interpretation. This is developing in the late 18th and the early 19th century. Actually, I suppose it, 18th and 19th. Now, negative rationalism was simply an application of these ideas of rationalism and optimistic historical study. It was an application to the Bible and to the Gospels in particular, which was more consistent than it was later in the figure of Reimarus, 1694 to 1768. Reimarus was a Hebrew teacher. Actually, he was a teacher of Oriental languages generally at the University of Hamburg. And his background very much is in the line with radical skepticism. He originally began to question Christianity when he just couldn't bring himself to believe that God would send people to hell. So that got him to reevaluating his understanding of Christianity and so forth, and he worked it through very consistently. Now, he did not publish his thoughts during his own lifetime. I guess he had some knowledge of what they might do if people might do if they read what he was writing. And in fact, they were published after he died, and in fact, his family did suffer because of their contents. Actually, they were published by a philosopher, Gottlob Lessing. Actually, he was more of a literary critic than a philosopher, but he published them anonymously under the title The Wolfenbüttel Fragments. Now, Reimarus was simply interested in describing or trying to come up with a rationalistic explanation for what happened with Jesus and the disciples that resulted in Christianity. His basic ideology was that reason must evaluate everything, and that nothing that cannot be demonstrated to reason can be accepted as being true. Reason is the ultimate criterion, and natural human values that we all know instinctively are the ultimate criterion of right and wrong, of moral truth. Now, again, here, with regard to that original question, he couldn't believe that that God would send people to hell. To him, it was revolting that God would send anybody to an eternal punishment. That struck him as being wrong, and therefore he said, that can't be right because I have a natural awareness that this is wrong, and my reason tells me it's wrong, and therefore it's not true. His second aspect of basic ideology was that miracles and prophecies, which were historically had been the main lines of proof for Christianity, could in fact not prove anything. In fact, miracles and prophecies by definition cannot happen because they're irrational. You see, a miracle is something that doesn't fit into the cause and effect continuum. It's not explainable in rational terms, and therefore it can't have happened. And prophecies, which actually predict things before they happen, violate the ordinary historical development, and therefore they couldn't have happened. So miracles and prophecies, first of all, couldn't have happened. Secondly, even if they had happened, they wouldn't prove anything. He's anticipating here a little bit. Lessing, we'll come to him later. But his point is that the historical accident of, say, a miracle, supposing it happened, cannot overthrow what he knows by reason. And he states at one point that no number of miracles and prophecies or signs and wonders could ever convince me that it is right to send a person to hell. So miracles couldn't happen, and they couldn't prove anything even if they had happened. Reimarus argued that Christianity is founded on three pillars: Old Testament prophecy, the resurrection of Christ, and the second coming of Christ. And he argued that Old Testament prophecy did not happen. Now, you might say, well, what about prophecies that we know that happened? Well, remember, he was a professor of Hebrew. He knew his Old Testament pretty well. And by a very narrow, an extremely narrow examination of the prophecies of the Old Testament, which the New Testament claims are fulfilled in Christ, he argued that they really didn't pertain to Christ at all, that there was some accidental historical similarities, but that actually the prophecies had a very narrow focus. For example, Isaiah 53 was really about the return of the remnant from Israel from Babylon. He argued that, Micah 5:2, the prophecy of Bethlehem, was really a back reference to David and the Davidic kingship. He had an explanation for everything. And he also pointed out that the fulfillment in the New Testament frequently do not correspond in their details to or preciseness to the form of the Old Testament prophecies. And so he argued that Old Testament prophecy did not, in fact, predict Jesus. He also argued against the resurrection, that it could not have happened because, obviously, people do not rise from the dead. And the parousia, the second coming, did not happen, and therefore that pillar of Christianity falls as well, and so Christianity is false. Now, his importance for this study of the Gospels lies in the fact that he was the first to try to reconstruct a life of Jesus. He reconstructed it, obviously, on the basis of these assumptions that he was making. And therefore, he came out with a Jesus which is quite different than the Jesus we see actually in the Gospels. First of all, he argued that Jesus originally had a political agenda. He did think of himself as Messiah and tried to fill that role, but of course a lot of people in the first century thought of themselves as Messiah and tried to fulfill that role. So he's not unusual in that respect. With regard to the miracles that are recorded in the Bible, Reimarus acknowledges that the disciples believed, or somebody believed, some Christians believed that Jesus had done miracles, but that the explanation lies in the fact that the original band of disciples, or perhaps Jesus working in contact with John the Baptist, stage managed the miracles. Anyway, Jesus' expectation was simply political, and not something beyond that as Christianity later developed. However, Jesus' political ambitions ended in catastrophe. He was crucified, and that left the disciples with not much to go on. So, according to Reimarus, the apostles were sitting around wondering what to do now because they had lost their power base, and they came up with a brilliant idea. Well, let's steal the body and tell people that he rose from the dead. That will make people believe in him again, and we'll have our power base back. So that's what they did. They stole the body, convinced people that he had risen from the dead, and that made the apostles very popular again and gave them back their power base. Jesus comes off in this work, by the way, which is called The Aims of Jesus and His Disciples. Jesus comes off pretty poorly, but the apostles come off atrociously. I mean, they come off like televangelists that are interested only in their own advancement and are using the whole situation for their own aggrandizement. Once the parousia did not happen, however, they were left with another quandary. How do we explain the fact that Jesus didn't come back? Well, Reimarus had an answer for that, too. They spiritualized it. The coming of Jesus was not then in the form of Jesus actually physically coming back to earth and judging it. Rather, it was in the form of the Holy Spirit coming and spiritually being present with his people in this world. So that was his reconstruction of the life of Jesus and his apostles. Well, after the publication, which was actually posthumous, as I mentioned before, there was a great deal of negative reaction. And in particular, it was directed against Gottlob Lessing, who had published the materials, once it was found out that he's the one that published them. Lessing tried to defend himself. He argued that, well, if you see a candle burning in a barn, and you realize that if nobody does anything about it, it's going to set the barn on fire. He felt he had to do something about it to let people know that this candle was burning. Well, another scholar who by no means would we want to call an evangelical or conservative, nevertheless responded to this that, well, yes, but that's like warning people about the candle by knocking it over and setting the barn on fire. That lets people know that there's a fire, yes, but that's not exactly the way to go about it. However, in spite of the fact that there was a great furor over these Wolfenbüttel fragments, it really didn't have much of an effect in terms of moving other people to follow in Reimarus's footsteps. So this marks a beginning to the whole attempt to reconstruct the life of Jesus. But it wasn't until quite some time later, that this consistent rationalistic attack on the Gospels was redeveloped or continued. As I said, it did result, however, in lots of attempts to write a rational explanation of the life of Christ, but from more of a conservative believing viewpoint or a semi-believing viewpoint. Before I get into particularly the naturalistic explanation or interpretation of Paulus, who kind of represents the pinnacle of this rationalistic, positive rationalistic explanation, just mention briefly that a lot of the major philosophers of the period, in fact, just about everybody, I'm not going to mention all of the philosophers, but particularly four of them I've listed on your outline there, got involved with these questions. Lessing is important primarily for his development of the relationship between metaphysics or philosophy and history. There's an aphorism now that is sometimes referred to as Lessing's ditch. Lessing's ditch simply is that there's a gap between historical knowledge and truth. Historical knowledge is accidental. It's limited to this world. Truth is something that transcends this world. It's much more general than the data that's around us. And so his ditch was simply can be summarized in two statements. No historical truth can be proven or demonstrated because of its very nature. You can prove that water, when it's heated, turns into a gas because you can prove it in a lab and scientifically repeat it and so forth. Historical truths cannot be demonstrated or proven because they're unrepeatable. You can never recover the exact historical situation. So the first element was no historical truth can be demonstrated or proven. And secondly, nothing can be demonstrated by historical truth. In other words, historical truth doesn't prove any truth either. It doesn't establish something as being genuinely the case always. Now, Lessing's ditch, you see when it's applied to Christianity, means that the historical accidents, such as are recorded in the gospel, have nothing to do with the truth of Christianity, such as the fact that God exists eternally, that he exists as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that he expects us to love one another. Those are truths that are general and absolute. They are not demonstrable by accidents of history, such as whether Jesus rose from the dead. So this provides a gap, you see. This is a ditch between historical truth, what happened, and general truths, such as that we ought to love one another. They are separated. Now, Lessing himself, again, regarded himself as a Christian, but his own philosophical development over the period of his life became increasingly pantheistic. And so by the end of his life, everything was God and God was in everything, in a kind of anticipation of the New Age. That is our 20th century New Age views. Immanuel Kant, of course, he's important. You've probably studied a lot about him in apologetics. But he has also affected the whole study of the life of Jesus. He came from an idealistic philosophical background and, again, wanted to retain that idealism, but recognized the difficulties inherent in the skepticism, particularly of Hume. I'm not going to go into the whole background of Kant. I'm really not intellectually equipped to do so. But I will point out that his basic orientation, the solution that he came up with in order to retain both a Christian truth and scientific study, was to take Lessing's ditch one step further and to argue that that our knowledge was always a construct of two elements. One, the phenomenal experiences, that is the data stream that we are confronted with constantly. And secondly, our mental framework, which was a given. And he argued that the phenomenal world, which is subject to scientific investigation and so forth, can never mean anything of itself. Meaning is supplied by the mind. And the mind is something that is a given. It applies structure. It imposes structure and ordering upon the data stream that is around us. Now, Kant believed that this mental structure was something that we were born with because we were in God's image. Kant regarded himself as a Christian, and he believed that we were this way. We could think this way because it was something given from God. However, you could never prove it. You could never scientifically demonstrate where these ideas came from, or that these ideas had anything to do with absolute truth. You can never know that. All you can know is the way in which your mind structures are imposing order upon the data stream. So knowledge is always limited to the ordering that our minds do upon the data stream or the phenomenal world. And Francis Schaeffer highly oversimplifies things, but at least you can think of it in Schaefferian terms, that the result of this way of thinking was that the phenomenal world, that is the world of isolatable, scientifically analyzable data, was never something that was absolutely true, because you cannot know a thing in itself. Kant likes to talk about the Ding an sich, the thing in itself that we cannot know. You cannot know things in themselves, what they really are in themselves. All you can know is our experience of them. These experiences are the phenomenal world, and we can see structure and ordering, but that ordering comes from somewhere else. Namely, the noumenal, or the mind, the realm of the mind, which is a given. Now, the noumenal, he believed, was in contact with ultimate reality, but it was not a contact that was demonstrable. So there was no proof of it. It was rather assumed. To put it simply, Kant argued, well, he got here by way of morals. He first demonstrated that pure reason is stuck down here and can never establish real truth. Pure reason, rationality, always operates in a very limited kind of universe. But practical reason, that is, in order for us just to live and to function, had to make certain assumptions. And in particular, he argued that he did have an indirect proof for God. It actually might remind you a little bit of some modern proofs. But he argued that first of all, I don't know on the basis of pure reason, I don't know that God exists. However, if God does not exist, life is meaningless. I sort of instinctively know that life is meaningful. Therefore, God must exist. So that was his proof, quote unquote, for God. You have to assume that God exists because I sense instinctively that life is meaningful, and without God, life isn't meaningful. So, but you see now what the result was of Kant's construction. The data stream, or the analysis of data, was highly restricted. Pure reason, scientific study, was highly restricted. It could not establish absolute truths. It was, in fact, not even related to absolute truths. And the truth of Christianity was entirely separate from the study of the historical material. And so when applied again to the Gospels, you can see how this made a big break then. The historical study of the Gospels had nothing to do with the truth of Christianity. There was this big break. Now, actually, Kant wrote he wrote A Life of Jesus. And in his Life of Jesus, he simply argued that Jesus was a great moral teacher, communicating the moral imperative, It's kind of like a pre-liberal life of Jesus. It's really not worth reading. Okay. By the way, Kant believed that he was saving Christianity. Lessing had argued that unless we separate out questions of history from questions of Christianity, Christianity is doomed. And Kant agreed with that and pressed it further and said that I'm going to make the separation complete so that the truths of Christianity are completely separate from historical study. And therefore, I've saved science from being shackled by the remnants of religion, and I've saved religion from being destroyed by the encroachments of rationality. So Kant thought highly of himself. He really did. I mean, if you start out his Critique of Pure Reason, you're just amazed at the chutzpah this guy has. He claims to have solved all the philosophical problems at the beginning of this book. Anyway, the next figure is Hegel. Now, Hegel agreed with Kant that there was this problem with the phenomenal world and noumenal knowledge of it. But Hegel wanted to recover some kind of connection between history and noumenal truth. And he did so by arguing that that essentially only mind exists. Only the noumenal world exists. And that our experiences and so forth are extensions out of it. Now, Hegel argued that this is not just the mind of an individual person. He's talking about mind with a capital M. He actually uses a word that in German is even more suggestive, Geist. Geist means not just mind or mental facility, it can also mean spirit. And consequently, he could use the kind of dual meaning of this word to encompass spirit, mind, as it were, something that was much bigger than just an individual's mind. And he argued that mind, which transcends the individual, is revealing itself and is becoming, is constantly becoming. And that it reveals itself in the process of history. Now, earlier philosophers had already suggested the idea that that there was a historical process in motion, and that any time you had an idea in history, that would have been answered by an opposite idea. Whenever an idea was developed, right from the beginnings of Greek philosophy, for example, any time an idea was developed, an answering idea, something that argued with it, would be developed, and that the dialectical relationship between these would then result in some new kind of ideas. Well, this was simply the thesis and antithesis idea. Now, Kant applied this motion of thesis and antithesis, which had already been recognized. Whoa. I'm sorry if you're already familiar with all this, but Hegel applied this this thesis-antithesis resulting in a new thesis. He applied this not just to the process of understanding ideas in history, but to a self-revelation of ultimate mind or ultimate truth in history. So that the development of ideas and the constant process of synthesis and resulting in a new antithesis and a new synthesis constantly throughout history, that this was a self-revelation of mind, or if you like, God. And we're going to have to take a break before we get into this, but he argued that therefore there was once again a connection between history and truth, because history was the revelation of this whole process. So it was not truth statically, but truth dynamically, truth in history, that was constantly unfolding and revealing itself. And that so we could know truth, but only by way of this process, only as part of this process. Anyway, back to Hegel, you have this basic orientation that through the processes of history, God is revealing himself, that is, the ultimate truth or mind is revealing itself, and that the focus then is not on the details of the history per se, but rather on the theological content of the historical revelation. And so that when he looks at the Bible, he's not so much interested in whether or not such and such a thing actually happened in history. He's interested in the way in which the ideas of history have resulted in development and a revelation of God. Now, Hegel himself was theologically, to some extent, I suppose, orthodox. He wanted to, he was fully willing to commit himself to the orthodox teachings of the Lutheran Church to which he belonged, but in fact he was very insistent on the importance of the Trinity. And that's because he saw the Trinity as, and particularly things like the deity of Christ, as very important developments and examples of this self-revelation of the mind, in that what's the ultimate antithesis of all? It's the distinction between God and man. And so Jesus represents the unity or the unification of God and man, the synthesis, as it were, into the new being, which was the climactic moment of this self-revelation of God through the processes of history. So he very much argued that the Trinity was an especially important, and that the hypostatic union was especially important. Now, Hegel had developed a vocabulary to describe revelation of this connection between history and truth, and his vocabulary. Two of the terms that he used was the Begriff, which is the idea, the concept, which was the genuine truth that was being revealed or that could be discussed, and the Vorstellung. Vorstellung means representation. So der Begriff, or the concept, was the ultimate truth that you were after. Die Vorstellung was the representative form in history which pointed to der Begriff. Now, the point here is that die Vorstellung, the representation, is not in itself important. It is important only as it points to, as it represents, der Begriff, the concept. Again, if you think of the Trinity, or better, is the hypostatic union, the incarnation. The incarnation of God in Christ and the unity of his Godhood and his humanity is a Vorstellung. It's a representation. It's not historically important by itself. It's not even historically provable, but rather it is a historical representation of the concept of synthesis, the unification of God and man. So this distinction would apply to all of the truths, quote unquote, of Christianity. There is a connection between history and truth, but it is an indirect connection. It's the connection that the truths or the concepts of Christianity are represented in historical forms. Okay, now that comes in, that becomes important, particularly in David Strauss that we'll see shortly. Finally, I'll just mention Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher is, of course, the father of liberalism. He had a Reformed preacher for a father, and his mother was a very pious Moravian woman. Schleiermacher reacted a lot against Hegel's kind of all-encompassing synthesis and reestablishment of history and truth. He reacted against it primarily because it boxed everything into one huge system. And Schleiermacher argued that that's not the way religion works. That's not the way the religious feeling operates. Rather, religious feeling is a matter of feelings of dependence upon the infinite. It's a very subjective thing. And Schleiermacher developed the concept of inwardness, of consciousness of one's own relationship to God, one's own dependence on the infinite. And true religion is a matter of these inward awareness of deity and commitment to these inward matters. Nevertheless, Jesus Christ, according to Schleiermacher, is extremely important because Christ is the archetype of recognition of this inwardness, this connection with God. And Schleiermacher even goes so far as to claim that the only way to God, the only way to become aware of God truly, is through Jesus Christ. So Schleiermacher was very much committed to the truth of Christianity as found in the Gospels. And Schleiermacher even got involved in writing A Life of Christ. Schleiermacher's Life of Christ was based heavily on the Gospel of John. The reason for that is that, surprising, John has the fewest miracles. Furthermore, John doesn't talk about demons. John is more concerned with the spiritual truths of Christianity. And so Schleiermacher felt that the Gospel of John was the best place to go for understanding Christianity or in understanding Jesus. He also regarded the Gospel of John as the most reliable historically. The reason being that the Gospel of John was, as most people understood it then, was written by an apostle. In fact, it was written by one of the inner circle of the apostles, John. Whereas the two of the other Gospels, Mark and Luke, were written by people that weren't even apostles. And Matthew, although it was written by an apostle, that he wasn't one of the central apostles. So the Gospel of John, according to Schleiermacher, was the most reliable. And it was also the nicest because it had the fewest miracles in it. It had the most deep spirituality. Okay, enough on Schleiermacher. I'm sure you're tired of hearing about Schleiermacher anyway. Now, all of this develops apace in the 19th century with approaches to the Gospels. I mentioned that Reimarus was a rather negative, took a negative approach to reconstructing A Life of Christ. This whole movement towards understanding Christ in a positive way and yet still through the lens of rationality reaches its climax in Gottlob Paulus, 1761 to 1851. Now, Paulus had a very unfortunate childhood. His mother died when he was quite young, like two or three. And his father was kind of wacko, and his father basically compelled his son to to act as a medium in seances communicating with his dead mother. And, you know, an impressionable young boy, and his father is putting this pressure on him. Paulus was a very sensitive young man, and of course his father, when he looked at Paulus, he saw a lot of his mother, and so he kind of compelled Paulus to act in this way. Well, that kind of turned Paulus off to any spirituality as such, but Paulus retained a very deep conviction of the truth of the stories of Jesus. But when he grew up, he very much rejected the whole idea that miracles could actually happen. But he wanted to keep on, he wanted to hold fast to the idea that these miracles, that the historical account that we have in the Gospels is reliable. Well, how do you do that? If you want to believe that the Gospels are telling a true story, and yet you don't believe in miracles, what do you do with all this stuff that's in the Gospels that record miracles? Well, you explain them. You come up with rational explanations for the miracles. Now, some of them you could argue may fit not too without too much difficulty. For example, healing miracles. Well, we have you can go to hospitals today, and you can hear people tell stories of remarkable recoveries. And you can hear people tell stories about how a person's faith and deep belief in God helped them to overcome a physiological difficulty. Or how, even how faith, not I'm not talking about Christian faith now, but simply a general cheeriness and optimism and love, experience of love, will help somebody to overcome physical ailment in sometimes very remarkable ways. Well, Paulus argued that a lot of the healing miracles was simply Jesus touching the spirit of individuals, giving them a new lease on life, so to speak, a new optimism, a new awareness of their relationships to God, and that was enough of a lift for them psychologically that they recovered from their illness. Likewise, cases of demon possession were really extreme anxieties or psychological difficulties that Jesus was able to overcome by infusing a new perspective into them. So that was the healing miracles Paulus thought he could explain, and he did so in quite detail. Now, resurrections, for example, the raising of the widow's son and so forth, that makes it a little harder. But even there, remember that the scientific world, the medical world at the time that Paulus was writing, was now discovering all kinds of things about such things as catalepsy and comas and epilepsy. Paulus argued that a lot of the that these resurrections were actually cases of catalepsy, that people thought that they were dead, but they weren't really dead. They were simply in a cataleptic trance. And that Jesus came along, prevented the guy from or the kid from being buried, and instead was able to touch him in such a way that it helped him to come out of this cataleptic trance. Now, Paulus does not bother to explain why it is that if Jesus knew that these people were not dead, instead of simply raising a few cataleptics and saving them from premature burial, by the way, Paulus adds these little titles. He has an account of the Gospels, and as you go through, he puts these little titles. Sometimes they're kind of ridiculous. The title for the widow of Nain, for example, the widow's son, is Jesus rescues a widow's boy from premature burial. He doesn't want to use the term raised from rising from the dead or anything. But you begin to wonder, well, if Jesus knew this, why didn't he simply instruct people about the nature of catalepsy and prevent a lot of other horrible premature burials rather than simply raises one person and mislead people. Well, Paulus didn't bother to ask that question. Sometimes it gets pretty ridiculous. Walking on the water. Well, Jesus, let me read a little excerpt here from you, for you. Let's see. Well, I didn't bring that little section, but here we go. The walking on the water. That was an illusion of the disciples. Jesus was actually walking along the shore, and in the mist was taken for a ghost by the alarmed and excited occupants of the boat. When Jesus called to them, Peter threw himself out into the water and was drawn to shore by Jesus just as he was sinking. Immediately after taking Jesus into the boat, they rounded a headland and drew clear of the storm center, and therefore they supposed that he had calmed the sea by his command. Likewise, when he was asleep during the storm, they woke him up, and he talked to them about wind and weather, and at that moment they gained the shelter of a hill, which protected them from the wind that swept down the valley, and they marveled that even the winds and the sea obeyed their Messiah. So he explains things as to how these ideas, these miracles developed. Now, transfiguration. He has an interesting explanation for. While Jesus was lingering with a few followers in this mountainous district, he had an interview on a high mountain at night with two dignified-looking men. His companions took these dignified-looking men for Moses and Elijah. These unknown persons, as we learn from Luke 9:31, informed him of the fate that awaited him at Jerusalem. In the early morning, as the sun was rising, the three disciples, who were just waking up and they're kind of blurry-eyed, and they looked up and they saw these dignified-looking men with Jesus on the higher part of the mountain, and they were illuminated by the sunlight because, you know, if you're up on the top of a hill and you're down in a little hollow and the sun comes up, then people look like they're glowing up there as the sun rises. So they saw him glowing with these two other strangers. And they were still talking about the fate which awaited him in the capital and so forth. And they heard an exhortation addressed to themselves, apparently by these dignified men, that they should hold Jesus to be the Son of God. Well, their drowsiness and the clouds, which in an autumnal sunrise float to and fro over the mountains, left them no clear recollection of what had happened. Apparently, you know, a misty cloud came along, and these dignified men walked down the hill on the other side, and so they thought that the dignified men had disappeared into heaven. This only added to their wonder of the vague and undefined impressions of having been in contact with apparitions from a higher sphere. Well, Paulus operates this way throughout the Gospels. Everything is explained. Even the death and resurrection of Jesus. He says the resurrection of Jesus was also a resuscitation. Paulus argues that Jesus died surprisingly quickly. The fact that he could utter a loud cry immediately before his head sank down shows that his strength was far from exhausted, and that what supervened was simply a death-like trance. In such trances, ordinarily, the process of dying may continue until actual corruption sets in, and that's the point at which that proves that he was actually dead. But in the case of Jesus, the vital spark was preserved because providence mysteriously... By the way, Paulus believes in providence. It's God who's working through all these fortuitous circumstances in the case of Jesus. Providence mysteriously effected on behalf of its favorite that which in the case of others was sometimes effected in more obvious ways by human skill and care. Jesus had got this lance thrust. By the way, according to Paulus, that was just a surface wound. And it actually served the purpose of a phlebotomy. Now, you know, we don't think very much of this anymore because we don't bleed people as a medical exercise, as a medical treatment. But Paulus is writing in the early 1800s, and one of the medical treatments was to get rid of some of the body poisons by a phlebotomy, by cutting a vein and letting some of the blood, which was thought to have poison in it, out. So this lance wound serves as a phlebotomy. It lets out some of the poisons in the body. And then he's put into a cool grave and treated with aromatic unguents. And this coolness of the tomb and the aromatic unguents and so forth continues the process of resuscitation. Then on Sunday morning, there is a storm and an earthquake. The earthquake wakes Jesus up. Fortunately, the earthquake also had the fortuitous effect of rolling the stone away from the mouth of the grave. Jesus then stripped off the grave clothes, put on a gardener's dress, which he managed to find somewhere, and that was why Mary mistook him for a gardener in John 20. And then the women send a message, and he's recovered, he's raised from the dead. Jesus appears to them, but Jesus has been severely weakened by all this that's happened to him. And so about 40 days later, he goes off somewhere, and he's never seen again. And so people think that he's risen that he's ascended into heaven. That was preceded, however, by their vision of him on a mountain, remember, that he was taken up into heaven. Well, he's got an explanation for that. On the Mount of Olives, again, in the early sunlight, you know, he's there down in the shadows, and he's up on the hill. In the early sunlight, he assembles his followers for the last time. He lifted up his hands to bless them, and with his hands still raised in benediction, he moved away from them. One of those clouds that float to and fro over the mountains interposed itself between them and him, so his eyes couldn't follow him, and he disappeared, clothed in white. And just as he was there, the two dignified people that had appeared with him on the Mount of Transfiguration, which they had mistaken for Moses and Elijah, they come back. They are, by the way, they're secret disciples. That's they come and they tell them not to stand there, but to be up and doing. Where Jesus died, they never knew, and so they came to describe his departure as an ascension. Well, there's some other ridiculous aspects of Paulus. We haven't got time. You'll see some of them in Strimpel. He goes in and tells some of these stories. But you've got the picture. That was kind of the climax of the whole positive, rational attempt to explain Jesus and marks, in a way, the end of an era, an attempt to explain, to hold on to the historicality of the Gospels while at the same time rejecting their supernatural aspects. I will mention, however, that this is not dead. People still will explain miracles in naturalistic terms. And in fact, I remember as a child hearing in church, my Sunday school teacher, this was a liberal church. My family was not at that time believers, but we did go to a liberal church. And the Sunday school teacher was talking about the feeding of the 5,000. And he said that the feeding of the 5,000 was able to happen because, remember the story of the little boy in Luke who brings his lunch. And everybody else is sitting around. We have no food. We don't know where to get food. This little boy comes up and he says, well, I've got a couple of little fish. And by the way, they are little fish. These fish that they get out of Galilee are very tiny. They form about a mouthful. And once you take the bone out. And so he had these two little fish and small loaves of bread. We're really talking about something the size of a roll. So he brings his lunch up and he says, well, I'll share. Well, you see, everybody else had also brought their lunches. But they looked around them and they saw everybody else without a lunch, and they didn't want to share their lunch because they realized they'd only end up with a crumb if they shared their lunch. So they kept it hidden. But once this little boy brought up his lunch, then they all were very sheepish, and so they pulled out. So as they're distributing the little boy's lunch, they're pulling out their real lunches too. And there's 12 basketfuls left over because everybody had brought their lunches. So the moral of the story is that you share your lunch, that you don't hold back. You share with people. Well, what I'm saying is this isn't churches today. Still, they're explaining a miracle by means of some kind of rational explanation. So it's not dead. Okay. Now. Remember, we noticed how Reimarus was a kind of negative, critical, extremely critical kind of approach. And developed rationalism in a very negative way, criticizing in a very consistent manner the whole product of the Gospels, the motives of Jesus and the disciples, in a very rationalistic explanation. And that resulted in a whole slew of kind of positive positive lives of Jesus that gave explanations for the miracles in a rational way, but wanted to retain something of a good Jesus and good disciples, and that climaxed in the person of Paulus. Well, that whole positive motion came to a screeching halt with a return to a negative approach of David Friedrich Strauss, or if you like, we'll just use two S's there. If you were at commencement, I made mention of David Friedrich Strauss because his birthday happens to be the 27th of January. And that's not terribly important. But Strauss once again began to apply a very consistent, rationalistic critique to the Bible. Let me explain a little bit of his background. First of all, he was influenced by Hegel's idea of historical development and the unfolding of truth by representations in history. So he accepted that basic idea. He also heard Schleiermacher teach, but was extremely disappointed with Schleiermacher, primarily because Schleiermacher had a high view of the Gospel of John. And Strauss had come to the conclusion that the Gospel of John was the least reliable historically. The fact that he was influenced by Hegel and this the concept versus the representation, Strauss argued, that the historical representations, the Vorstellungen, the historical representations are not themselves important and are, in fact, myth. Strauss was the first to apply the term myth to the Gospels. Now, Strauss's own philosophy was that the divine incarnation was in humanity as a whole. So Jesus was not something in particularly important here. Jesus was not the incarnate Son of God in a distinctive sense. Rather, Jesus was the focal point of a revelation in history that enabled human beings to realize the divinity within them. So divinity within humanity as a whole. That was the concept which was represented in the Gospels. But the Gospels themselves were essentially mythological ways referring to these things. Myths in the ancient world generally frequently had this function. For example, the myths, the Greek myths, or the Roman myths of Zeus or Jupiter, they were essentially ways of representing or trying to represent the general truths of the world. During the Greek period and the Roman period, it's likely that very few people who were not children believed that there was an actual person who did these things in a very literal kind of fashion. Rather, the myths were ways of expressing the general deity that was around them. So a hearth god, for example, was not an actual, to some extent there was a person, but the idea was that everything in the universe was personal. And so everything was personalized.